Good evening, everybody. My name is Margaret, and I'm a very grateful recovered member of this fellowship. That was for the benefit of the person who wanted to hear the Boston accent, which I don't have. All right. Sorry, I can put it on when I have to, if I want to fit in down the stock market or something like that, but I'm not from Boston originally, so I don't really come by it, honestly. So, thank you so much for having me here. I know some of you, some others of you also look familiar. I'm not totally sure. I know several people from OA service over the years, and I know Marcia. I led the Manuka retreat back, and she thinks 03. And so through an amazing set of circumstances, we got hooked up together, and she asked me to come out here. I was really excited because I'd never been to Seattle before. I'm going to write something up here that was inspired by the activity that Bill just talked about with our sticky notes. What's in the way is the way. I came to Overeaters Anonymous in February of 1990, 215 pounds of chain-smoking suicidal fun. In November of 1990, I was granted the gift of abstinence, and through the grace of God and the working of the 12 steps, it has not been necessary for me to give that gift back, for which I am unbelievably grateful. This is through no work of my own, because if it was simply a matter of controlling the food that went into my mouth, I would have licked this problem a long, long time ago. When I came to Overeaters Anonymous, I didn't actually know what my problem was. I may still not, but I think I'm getting closer to it. It kind of doesn't matter because the solution is working. I've accepted the solution, and if I still don't fully 100% comprehend what my problem, the totality and severity of my problem, as long as I continue to apply the solution, it'll do until I get it. Something's working. Also bearing in mind that to my body, it's now 11:20, so I'm going to be good until 9 o'clock, and then I will fall like a tree. I might be a little scattered right now because I'm not speaking from carefully prepared notes. We have your retreat leaders are unbelievably wonderful in all of the details that are here. So before I start going, actually I'd just like to invite everybody to join with me in doing something that I'm going to find it very necessary to do, which is breathe. Take in a nice big belly breath. No one needs to hold their stomach in here, okay? At no point. Another thing that I would actually even invite you to do, even if only for a moment, is to unfold your bodies. Unfold your arms, unfold your legs, and for a moment, just for this moment, and then fold right back up again if that's where you want to go. Just allow your soft underbelly to be exposed to the vibrations of everybody else in the room. For the last month, I was undergoing a very wonderful, amazing experience, a very intensive training in something other than the 12 steps, something that without my recovery in the 12 steps I never would have been able to make use of. And it was an incredible compliment to my recovery. It was a wonderful compliment to my recovery, but what I can say is that it was a lot about doing things like that, about breathing, about allowing things in and allowing things out. So if over the course of this weekend I start weeping copiously or not, it's okay. It's not a problem. As a matter of fact, I invite you, if you're moved to weep, never to try not to. Because this is the place to see and be seen, to hear and be heard. That's how we recover together. As I was starting to say, your retreat leaders and myself, we've done preparations. Tomorrow you're going to get all these handouts that are going to have all these words and quotes and stuff like that. But the main event of this weekend is for us to be in presence together and to share this experience, strength, and hope that every single one of us has. Whether or not this is your first retreat, your 50th retreat, your first week in Overeaters Anonymous, or, you know, your first century, whoever, we all bring the same measure of presence to this place, and that's what's really healing us here. And the words are nice, you know. Although the literature, I don't want to in any way downplay the importance of our literature in my recovery or the experience of the 12 steps. But breathing is great. When I came into Overeaters Anonymous, I came in through the side door through another program, and as I said, I still really didn't have that much of a clue what my problem was. I thought I had a weight problem, of course. Now, that other fellowship, I had to surrender to addictions. I'm also an alcoholic and drug addict. And I had to recover, I had to surrender to those. I don't know what would have gotten me into Overeaters Anonymous. Maybe never, you know, because every year they come out with some new thing to do about weight, and I would have chased after it all. By 1990, I had been through every method of controlling my eating and my weight that was available to me myself on my own. I had gotten the books. There was always the Xerox diet plan that somebody at the office was handing out. Does anybody remember eating the seven this one day? One day it was grapefruit, then it was eggs, and yeah, okay. There was cabbage soup. Anybody remember farting through that one? Yeah. Eventually I went on to the full books. You know, the guy who got murdered, you remember him? Did that. Eventually I had to go on to the stronger stuff, which were the support groups. Eventually, one that cost thousands of dollars, thousands and thousands of dollars. And everyone succeeded if weight was my problem, because every one of them enabled me to lose weight. But none of them solved my problem, because weight was not my problem. My story is very typical. I lost my set of pictures. I have not put together a new set of pictures. But if you saw my pictures, what you would see was a very typical story of a compulsive overeater. You would see possibly hints of that time when I also contacted my anorexic side. I never lost so much weight as to be unhealthy, but I not only know about the high of binging, but I also know about the high of starving and purging. My disease was arrested at a point at which those had not reached the critical level that my compulsive overeating did, my drinking and drugging. But I know them as aspects of my disease. So what you would see in my pictures is just somebody who started out as a normal little kid. Age 7, you would see that I started getting a little chubby. Age 9, I was fat. By the age 11, I was obese. Then in junior high, you would see that my weight started to fluctuate a little bit, and that's because I had found drinking and drugs and smoking cigarettes, especially. When I had my first cigarette, I was just, you know, where have you been all my life? Yeah, you're nodding. You know, for an oral compulsive, it was everything. And so on I went, you know, merrily switching seats on the Titanic until I was, that's for those of you who have not heard that one, that's, you know, essentially when you're moving from one addiction to the other, thinking, well, that's okay, I don't have a problem with drugs because I'm not addicted to any one. And that's you know, that's really what I told myself. I can remember in high school I was actually proudly saying that I didn't have a drug problem because I wasn't addicted to any single drug. And that was true. You know, I could always just go from one to the next. And that's what they mean when they say you're switching deck chairs on the Titanic. The ship's going all in the same direction. The view is a little bit different from, you know, which deck you're on. But, you know, I had the speed deck, and I had the coke deck, and I had the pot deck. And, of course, there was the eating and the not eating decks. There was the getting high on dieting. There was the binging my face off. So when I got to Overeaters Anonymous, it was because certain of my secondary addictions had been eliminated from my life. And finally, I was able to start seeing what my problem was. Now, when I put down some of the other substances, what started to happen was people started to tell me that many people found it was good to eat particularly sweets to ward off cravings for certain things. Now, a craving to do whatever didn't have a snowball's chance in hell of getting within 200 yards of me, because my blood sugar level was at a, you know, preemptive, you know, turned up to 11. Pretty much all the time. I followed that suggestion quite a lot. But what I started to see was that I wasn't sober if I was eating the way I was eating. So I started to see that I had not a weight problem. Weight was just a symptom of my food problem. And then, I don't know when it was when I finally got the memo. Oh, I don't even have a food problem. I have a thinking problem. Food is just a symptom. And that is, I think, a really important thing to note, that our 12 steps only mention food once, and only in the first half of the first step. And then the next time it gets to that, it's in step 12, it's not even talking about our own eating, it's talking about helping somebody else. So since food is only mentioned in the first half of the first step, it's probably a pretty good indicator that food is not the real problem. And the rest of the steps give us a clue as to what our problem might actually be. It was 1990 that I came into this program, and I hated it. Hated it. Because it wasn't like my other fellowship. For one, you know, it just wasn't as cool, you know. Because, you know, let's face it, when I was out there using, I really thought I was Lou Reed, you know. Here I was, just picturing myself as this kind of edgy, you know, whatever. I was an obese secretary going to work with my dress and my, you know, tennis shoes, seeing myself as something completely not what I was. If anybody can identify with distorted self-image. My weight was my defining factor. It was my everything. It had been my everything for years. It was my primary scapegoat. You know, I'll be happy as soon as I'm X number of pounds. It was my refuge, because I could hide behind it for everything. It was my excuse never to try. I put it between me and you, because I made the assumption that the first thing you saw when you looked at me was my weight. Now, that might have absolutely been true, but you didn't have a chance, because whatever you saw, whatever you said, however you behaved, I was going to believe that it was conditioned by your opinion of me, and your opinion of me was only going to rest on the fact that I was fat. That was it. So this was a distortion of thinking, but these distortions of thinking went back a long way. That's the mind that I brought into Overeaters Anonymous. I said that I got here and I hated it. And one of the things that I hated about it, of course, was the people who were recovering. Now, in the other fellowship, I was relieved of the cravings day one, no problem. I got here, and I started seeing people and hearing people in meetings saying, for example, I've been abstinent, you know, X number of months or a year and a half or whatever, and I have lost X number of pounds, and I eat 3 meals a day with nothing in between, no flour, no sugar, and I love my food, and I don't miss the blah, 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 whatever. And I would sit there in the back of the room, or the front of the room, it didn't really matter, I wasn't necessarily hiding, but I hated you, and I would just sit there and, you know, kind of target you in my mind, because that wasn't going to be possible for me. That was simply not going to happen. I knew that. Now, here's another distortion of thinking. I sat in these rooms, having been granted a complete and utter reprieve from death by the other addiction, and yet I did not believe that this was possible for me. Not only that, but I resented you bitterly for saying that you had it. Not only that, I still thought you were judging me. Like, I thought if somebody sat up there and said, this is what I do, this is what I have, and I'm so grateful, I immediately tacked onto the end of the sentence, and you should be doing it too, you know, weak-willed, lily-livered, whatever. But that was how my thinking ran. And you know what? I still have that same brain. Fortunately, I didn't really have to fully comprehend what my problem was to start recovering in this program. This is what kept me coming. I had never in my life been in a room of people who understood what it was like to live between my ears. Ever. I had been in plenty of rooms with people who had my problem in those, you know, those places where people went to lose weight. There were plenty of people there who shared my experience, but we never talked about it honestly. We never really told the truth about how scared we were, or how hopeless we felt, or how angry we felt. Certainly we never talked about how angry we felt. You know, maybe a little bit would slip out now and then, but for the most part we were just laughing and jolly and, oh boy, I'm going to lick it this time. Yeah, wee! So when I came here, that was the big attraction, that you told my story, that I heard people talking honestly about what it was to be ruled by food to be unable to stop. And not only that, you told me that that did not make me a bad or weak person. You told me that no amount of trying in the world was ever going to prevail against this problem. I had not brought this on myself. So that would have been enough, really, to be in a place in which I found unconditional and absolute acceptance exactly as I was. That was enough for a while, and I gained weight after I came into Overeaters Anonymous. I came to meetings, and for the first time, not only, well, as I said, I resented you bitterly if you'd lost weight and you were absent and stuff like that, but I also knew that it was okay for me to keep coming. For the first time in my life, I actually started buying clothing that fit. I used to go into the department store. I would never, ever, ever go to the plus size stores. I would go to the regular department store and I would buy a size 18, 20, 22 garment, despite the fact that that's proportion for a woman who's 6'3", you know, and I'm 5'3". And if I could close the zipper, I bought it, regardless of the fact that, you know, the shoulders came down to my waist or whatever. But for the first time when I came to this program, I started buying clothing that fit because I started to accept myself as I was. And the thing was, at that point, that was enough because I accepted the fact that I was fat and I was going to be fat because I was never going to be able to abstain and lose weight. See, at this point, the diets had stopped working. I had so destroyed my metabolism that I could no longer diet. So I had started to work the steps. I had started to, do them to the best of my ability in the other program, and that's how I got to see how not sober I was when I was still turning to the food. And I started coming to Overeaters Anonymous, and I started coming more regularly, and eventually I found a meeting that felt a little bit more comfortable, and I actually started to like Overeaters Anonymous. I started to take service positions, first because I was I was a good girl, so I was going to do things like that. And eventually because I wanted to. And I started slowly to work with a sponsor, and she was very encouraging, very simple. She never gave me a food plan. Nobody ever gave me a food plan. But what I started hearing in meetings, instead of, this is what I do and it's impossible, so don't even bother, I started to hear something that sounded doable to me. And so I was putting together a week, maybe a couple of weeks, I think maybe at the most, of something that looked like abstinence. And so here we are, it's February of 1990, I start coming to meetings. We're getting towards the fall, and I had this horrific Halloween when if you measured the poundage of what I put into my body that day, it would have been minuscule compared to what I'd been able to put away before that. It was the lack of control. And I'll just tell this one story. I lived on the third floor. It was a house that had been converted to apartments. And the family, there was a mother on the first floor, and her daughter and son-in-law lived on the second floor. And Mom had bought this huge bowl of candy. It was still sitting in the foyer. You know, trick-or-treating was long over. I'm lying in bed. Now I want a couple of those things. So I tip downstairs, get a couple, go back upstairs, eat them. That's going to be it. And I tiptoe back downstairs. Three more, that's it, for real. And then I go back downstairs, and you know how that goes. And I just remember lying in bed, hating myself so much because it was so completely out of my control. And the pain of that bingelet was part of what propelled me finally in the middle of November to look ahead. And I remember thinking, God, I know this is a day at a time program, but I was looking at the upcoming holiday season, looking down the barrel of that shotgun, and knowing that in the past it had always been, here come the holidays, I'm going to, you know, my eating's going to ratchet up for a while, and then it's going to come January, and I'm going to pull myself, you know, together, whatever, go on a diet, whatever. And what I knew now was that no longer happened. When the level went up, it stayed up until it went up again. There was never any coming back. And I couldn't face it. And I said, God, I know it's a day at a time program, but I have got to start abstaining now. And I call November 15th my date of abstinence, my anniversary, because, and I don't know, it was somewhere the week before Thanksgiving, but I didn't know that my last binge was my last binge. So that's why I don't really know exactly what that date is, but that's what I use. I am still just amazed to have that miracle in my life. But what I'll tell you is, so that happened in 1990. But the fact that I can say that I'm abstinent, that I have been abstinent for 20 years since then, is not because, phew, got there, good, just going to hang out here for a while. It has been a journey, like everybody's here. I can't stay abstinent on yesterday's abstinence. And at the same time, I still have to repeat the same actions that I did that first week. Okay, so I worked the steps. Now, this weekend, we're really going to be looking primarily at steps 1, 2, and 3, and traditions 1, 2, and 3, which is not uncommon for a weekend retreat, but I would be doing a great disservice if I didn't talk about the importance of all the steps. As a matter of fact, to me, it is not possible to do the first three steps and stop. I know I've heard many people say, well, I'm stuck on step 3. As far as I can tell, and forgive me for making, you know, sort of a statement, but this is just from my observation, and of course I could be totally wrong, but this is how it looks to me, is, and I have my own experience to draw on, that's for sure. If I believe that I have stopped at step 3, what's probably more likely is that I haven't quite finished step 1. I may have put the food down, but I probably haven't admitted or seen that my life is unmanageable, because if that were the case, it would propel, if I knew how screwed I was by that fact, it would probably propel me forward to believe that something might have a solution for me, and then to make the commitment to move forward. To me, the evidence that someone has taken the third step is that they're writing their fourth step, because that's what step 3 is. It's a commitment to move forward. And then do steps 4 through 9. And once you've done steps 4 through 9, why waste all that work? Keep doing steps 10, 11, and 12, and live in all 12. I mean, because that's what 10, 11, and 12 are. It's living in all the steps. 10, 11, and 12 are all 12 steps. All of them. Every day. What I can tell you is that I have worked the 12 steps, and I can also tell you that I am, if anybody is worried that, you know, they have to do them perfectly, I stand before you an example of how you can stay in this program and not do it perfectly, because I certainly have not. But the wonderful thing is that no matter where I've been, there's always been the next step waiting for me in this program. And, you know, I have gotten outside help. I have found spiritual paths not in this fellowship that have enlarged my life. But this is my foundation. I started abstaining, and like many people who are addicted, what started to happen was that I got worse. Now, of course, there was the great leap. There was the wonderful feeling of not waking up sick, hungover, filled with guilt and fear that I was going to just do it all over again. That was a tremendous relief. But not too long after the food was down, the weight started coming off. It was great. It took me about a year to lose 80 pounds or so. But I started to realize why I ate, and that's why I say what I got worse. And over the next couple of years, I started experiencing a lot of anger, a lot of problems in relationships. I got married. When I was 10 years abstinent, my marriage fell apart spectacularly and painfully, and I learned how much farther I had to go into this surrender process. And then I recommitted. Well, I've been working the steps. I started working them in a much deeper way. So I do believe that no matter where I am in recovery, there's certainly always more recovery to go. And I've never had a situation arise for me that has not been addressed by the program. And I've never found a situation that hasn't been experienced by someone in the fellowship that they can share with me. The last time I did step 3, and I return to step 3 on a daily basis, the last time, well, okay, so step 1, admitted we were powerless over food and that our lives had become unmanageable. So I had to really understand what that meant, and we'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. So when I really understand that if you have the disease of compulsive eating, it's like stepping out of a 30-story window. You cannot decide to fall five floors. You're going down once you accept that you have this disease. So once I was able to understand, oh my Lord, I really am truly hopeless and doomed by this disease, then thank goodness I was able to come to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. In no way did step two require me to believe in God. No. As a matter of fact, such belief as I had in God was helpful, but it was just, in some ways it could have been an impediment, but not too much of one, because I think when I came into this program, I still had a little confusion between guys with white beards. One was the image of God that I'd been raised with, and the other was the image of Santa Claus that I'd been raised with, and I was confusing the two, you know. Because both of them seem to have this deal whereby if I just mix the right combination of supplication and whining and appearing to be good, I should get everything I wanted. And so if I didn't get everything I wanted, that meant that God was a sham. That's Santa Claus. So fortunately in this program, what I was told was just don't worry about any of that. Do you believe that there is a power greater than, that is, there is a power that's not you, that can restore you to sanity? And since you had no reason to lie to me, and you showed me the evidence that you were telling me the truth, that was all I needed to believe enough to move forward to the next thing. Did I want what you had? Yes. Step two, done, ka-ching. Step three, a little more serious, except that my problem really arises of myself, and make a commitment that it is myself that I'm going to offer to be changed. Not determine I'm going to change myself, but offer to be changed. And also admit that I had no idea what that change is going to be. Okay, great. Step three, ka-ching. Make a commitment. I'm going to move forward with this. I've made a decision to turn my life and my will over to the care of God. Step three does not say turned our life and our will over to the care of God. It said made a decision to do so. Because at that point, I didn't have this God in my life. I had this, sort of the 911 God, you know, to be used in emergencies. Or we had a relationship, it just wasn't a good one, or, you know, something like that. So in step three, what I was really doing was making a decision that's what I was going to do. I simply had absolutely no idea what that meant or how to do it. That meant I had to be willing to be teachable, and so I was guided into step four. In step four, I was willing to take an inventory, and it was a searching and fearless moral inventory, and it was to be guided by people who had done it before. And I've used many different formats. The last time I did it, guided by somebody using the instructions in the Big Book. And those have produced the best results for me. And I looked at my resentments, I looked at my fears, I looked at my sex conduct. Those were fun times. And I admitted what I had found there to God, to another human being, in a fifth step that seemed to stretch on forever. But in step six, I looked at what I had just told someone, and all the ways that I behaved, all the things that I had believed. That's what I had to really look at, was my thinking. Remember that distorted thinking that thinks that all you see when you look at me is fat. I had to look at that and admit, you know, my thinking might not be entirely reliable. Self cannot reveal self to self. I had to accept somebody else's method of looking at it. In step six, all I had to do was to look at that and go, do you still want to be like this? Is this the way you want to continue living your life? No. I was entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Doesn't mean that I, you know, was even knew what they all were at that point, but I was willing not to be like that anymore. Step 7, I humbly ask God to remove them. And the difference between humbly asking and just asking is that the humility part, I'm still grappling with that, of course. Some of you also might know what I'm talking about. Is that I had to understand my part in it, which is it was going to be on God's timetable, and it was going to be up to God what got shifted. As it says in the big book, the prayer says, I ask God to remove all the shortcomings that stand in the way of my usefulness to God and to my fellows. So that may mean that some of them don't shift because they're not, I don't know, whatever. It's basically, in other words, it's not my laundry list to dictate to God. God, if I'm listening, is going to let me know. And in step 8, I made a list of all the people that I had harmed that I knew of and became willing to make amends to them. In step 9, I went directly to those people and I made those amends. And it didn't kill me. And that was when fear really started to leave my life. And having done steps 4 through 9, it gave me a new blueprint for living, which I repeat on a daily basis, you know, more or less. I have had a practice of doing a written 10th step at night, waking up with a practice of prayer and meditation, asking God to direct my thinking on a daily basis. I sponsor quite a few people. I try to bring people through the steps anytime they ask me to. And I have a sponsor, and I do a lot of service. I've done service at pretty much every level of the OA service structure, which has been fantastic. As a matter of fact, this is the first time in my life that I have not had a job at intergroup, region, or world service level. I don't even have a group job right now. I have to, you know, in January, I have to get back to that. And as a result of all these things, I can honestly say that I have that life second to none. You know, on a really good day, well, I guess they're all really good days because I'm not compulsively eating. All right, so on the days that I call really good days, but I would be lying if I sat up here and said, and every day that I'm doing God's will for me is just a joyful experience from start to finish. No, I have my own agenda. A lot of times I will stop and have a long list of all the things that I think I should be doing in my life, and if this was happening, I'd be happy. It's the same old thing. And always, if I was 5 pounds lighter, things would be perfect. And so there's still an enormous amount of self-will running riot all the time. But I'm really having glimmers of what's talked about in the promises of genuinely feeling in many cases that I'm just not as interested when those thoughts come up that, oh, I'd be so happy if I had X, Y, or Z. I really do have glimmers of going, well, or not. You know, maybe you could just be content with what you have right now. I can write a gratitude list. I can make a phone call. I can genuinely listen to somebody. And I would not say that any of the crazy thoughts, the little judgments, oh, anybody have arguments with people in their head? Anybody wrestle with ghosts? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Constantly having those, but it doesn't take very long for me to notice them when I'm stuck in one of those tape loops. It really doesn't take a very long time for me to go, oh, there's that going again, and I take it very lightly. I really don't. This is probably one of the best things. The tapes are still there. A lot of the negativity is still there. A lot of the selfishness is still there. Do you love me? Do you love me? How am I doing? You know, what are you thinking of me? Because God knows I'm thinking of me. Is still there, but it doesn't go for very long before it's seen. And then I wear it lightly. I don't get impatient with myself as much anymore because it's still there after 20 years. And that is what allows it to loosen its hold. I don't need to push myself away from myself anymore. I can really claim what's in the way is the way. And that applies to so much. So if what's in the way is my being a compulsive overeater, that was my way to this life. That was my route to God. If I had not been an addict, I can't imagine what ever would have induced me to seek a relationship with a power greater than myself. How many people do you know who just, you know, one day go, well, I enjoyed knitting for a while, and then there was all that time that I, you know, was building ham radios. Now I think I'll build a relationship with God. We're thrown up against the wall. When I first started hearing people say that they were grateful compulsive overeaters, you know, at first I just scoffed, and then I thought, well, yeah, I can understand that. If I have to be a compulsive overeater, then I guess I'm grateful that I'm recovering, that I'm no longer having to actively eat compulsively. But you know what? Now I'm just grateful to be an addict because that was God's way of getting my attention. I'm so grateful. I'm going to close pretty soon. I just want to share something that happened over the last month. It was so wonderful. I had to immediately run out and make a phone call. So I'm at this thing, and there's this woman. She's 23 years old, which is when my life was really going off the rails. There was this thing I wanted to do with my life, and it was so not happening. Here she was. She was 23 years old, and she was me to a T. Physically, she looked at me like me at that age. She was very smart, made sure you knew it. She said, pointing at herself, because that's exactly the way my thing goes. Look at me, look at me, look at me. Well, she wasn't like that. But she, you know, she's very smart, definitely wanted to make sure you knew it. And I saw, so I started going, wow, that was me at that age. And then, of course, I started into, well, that was me at my age, that was me at that age. If only I hadn't been derailed by my tragic addictions, I could have had a wonderful life. And then I watched her as she struggled, tormented with perfectionism, with a desire to be right, with a desire to get it right. And I realized that that had been, well, beaten out of me, beaten by myself out of me. God's never beaten me. And first, the first thing that happened was that I caught the self-pity. It was barely out the barn door, and I went, self-pity! Ah! And I realized that that morning I had prayed for God to remove thinking like self-pity. And I recognized it, I saw it, and psh, it was gone. And the next thing I realized was, I have been, you know, I've told myself this story over so many years, what my life would be like if I had never picked up. I have no idea. You know what? So this woman is wonderful. She had an amazing experience. Love her. Nothing wrong with being her. But what if I had never gotten off the train of that self-centered torment? What if that perfectionism train had just kept going? That was a horrible head to live in. And only because that was in the way was that my way out of it. And it was just, it was such a tremendous gift to see just in that small thing, something that I had been given by recovery. And so I shared that with somebody. And there was something else miraculous I was going to, some other great slogan, who knows. I'm full of, I have a lot of slogans. Anybody who's been around for a while, you know, we all have lots of really great slogans. So I'll sling some more of them. So wrapping up with some great joke or line or something like that. Don't have any. It's a miracle I'm still awake. It's midnight. So this weekend, we're going to have a snack soon, which is always great. There's another slogan. So for those of you who are hoping that this weekend is going to be the start of abstinence, it already is. You've been abstinent since you stepped in this room. Doesn't get any better than that. Really doesn't. One of my favorite sayings, there's always another meal coming. No one ever died of hunger between lunch and dinner. It's the truth. There's always another meal coming. If you can, just allow that thought in. No matter what your experience was before you came here, no matter whether it's you've never been able to get abstinent, you're in relapse, whatever it is, you're afraid, just let that thought in right now. Don't worry about tomorrow. Don't even worry about tonight. Just let that in right now, because there is absolutely no reason for anybody in this room ever to eat compulsively again, ever. Really. That's the truth. So tomorrow we'll be doing some breakout groups, so we'll actually have, we will have a time in the morning. Everybody's going to get their voice into the room again, hopefully when all the commuters have gotten here. So I encourage you to keep breathing, and I encourage you to relax your body whenever you find it tensed up, especially the face. You know, a lot of times if you can relax your face, you notice that a lot of other tension just drains right out of you. Because that's where we store everything that's trying to stop our expression. When we're trying not to tell the truth, it starts in our face. The smile goes up, This whole apparatus just stops expression. What happens when you're about to cry? Your throat gets tight. That's your throat actually clamping down. And it's not necessary here. Be generous with each other, with yourself. Drink a lot of water. Pee when you have to. Take a break when you have to. Nobody's taking attendance. The small breakout groups are really nice for also being able to share more intensely. They can be. I don't really have much else to add to that. I'm sure I'll think of it in about 15 minutes, but that's okay because I'll probably be fast asleep by that point. So with that, I hand it back over to Bill.